The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I've been talking about the five faculties for the last number of times I've been here. And today I'd like to focus on the fifth of the five faculties. The five faculties are faith or confidence, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So today I'd like to focus on wisdom and how it actually, even though it's considered the fifth of the five faculties, it really both is needed at the beginning in terms of just understanding the direction of what we're doing, and it is the fruition, also the deep understanding of things as they are is the fruition of our practice. So we can think about the five faculties as a cycle, actually. We need some amount of wisdom, some understanding of what we are trying to do in order to have any kind of faith or confidence or a willingness to engage in that. So the willingness is kind of the first manifestation of confidence of faith. That willingness has to be connected with something. So we are not just willing in the abstract to do something. We have something that we're heading towards. And that something we're heading towards generally has come to us as a teaching of some kind. And that's wisdom. So wisdom begins for us with hearing, with listening, with reading, with gathering some information about a direction. And in the practice, in our meditation practice, in our spiritual practice, this tradition, there are kind of four main areas of wisdom that we learn about. And I won't go into detail in all of these today because each one of them could be one or more talks. An understanding of what is skillful and unskillful in terms of what creates suffering and what lets us move away from suffering. What creates affliction for self or others and what supports moving away from affliction for self or others. Those things that move us away from harming, from causing suffering for either ourselves or others, those things that move us away tend to be skillful states of mind and actions. Those things that lead us towards suffering, towards harming of self or others, tend to be unskillful. And so there's a whole range of teaching on what are skillful mind states, mental qualities, and behaviors. And we've talked about some of these in this class. Skillful states tend to be those that are not based in greed, aversion, and delusion. So non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. States of mind and actions that arise out of intentions of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion tend towards happiness, towards non-suffering. And states that tend to lead us towards, or states that arise out of greed, aversion, and delusion tend to lead us towards suffering, harming, unhappiness. So that basic understanding of when we're operating or acting out of greed, aversion, and delusion, that is going to cause us suffering or harm at some time or other. That's a kind of wisdom. Just hearing that teaching can come into your mind and begin perhaps to help you navigate some of your actions in your lives. So that's one aspect of the wisdom teachings, the understanding what's skillful and what is unskillful with respect to suffering, stress, dissatisfaction. A second kind of wisdom that is described in this Buddhist tradition is an understanding of cause and effect. Understanding, and this is related in a sense. All of these are actually very related. They're kind of different ways of exploring the same terrain. That cause and effect basically means that our actions have consequences. Both our bodily actions, our actions of speech, and our actions of mind all have consequences. They don't happen in a vacuum. Things don't happen randomly in terms of our behavior. The way we suffer or feel at ease is not a random event. It is due to causes and conditions. There are things that may come from the outside that perhaps feel random, but even things like, you know, an earthquake or a tsunami, those things feel kind of perhaps random to us, but they're also a result of natural causes and conditions in the environment. They may not have a personal cause. I mean, I don't particularly believe in the notion that, you know, that things happen, you know, an earthquake happens because the people in that area were bad or something. You know, that is not my mode of, my way of thinking about things. I tend to think of it as just as forces of nature, very impersonal forces of nature. But they are regular, they are due to causes and conditions. It's not random what happens. And in our lives, in our own experience, the way that we experience our lives, the way that we connect with our experience is, and this can be hard to understand and believe, it's entirely due to our own way of meeting that experience, whether we suffer or feel at ease around it. I'm not saying that what happens to us is related to how we feel and act about it. It has an impact, but whether we suffer or feel at ease about anything that happens to us is entirely dependent on our own mind state. So the cause of happiness in our lives lies entirely within our own minds. This is really good news. It is really good news. If we were subject to just kind of random things coming, chaotic things coming, and we'd had no possibility of meeting things in a particular way, our happiness would be subject to the whims of nature, the whims of the world. But because of this, it's a natural law, and this it's kind of the law of karma, which is again a huge topic. But it is again connected to the teaching on skillful and unskillful, that when we act out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, that's the cause that creates the conditions for future happiness, future non-suffering. If we act out of greed, aversion, delusion, that's the cause that tends to directly lead us towards suffering, towards unhappiness. So this directly leads us towards exploring when we are acting out of greed, aversion, and delusion, seeing if we can meet that noticing when greed, aversion, and delusion arise in our minds, can we just meet that instead of act out of it? If we turn towards just the arising of these states of mind and choose to not act out of them, that's the turning in our practice. That's the turning towards non-suffering, because we're choosing to not act out of those unskillful mind states. That choosing to not act out of greed, aversion, and delusion, it kind of begins to turn the ship, you know, turn the battleship, you know, battleships are hard to turn. You know, they take a long time to turn. So, you know, that just turning away from acting is the beginning of turning towards non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. Essentially, what happens in that case is that instead of acting out of those states of mind, acting out of anger, frustration, hostility, desire, wanting, excitement, anger, instead of acting out of boredom, frustration, all of those states of mind, we turn and observe them. We look at them. It's possible, and essentially what happens is that before we were noticing, before we were willing to turn and meet those states of mind, we were essentially kind of like looking through those states, and everything we saw was colored and filtered by those states. And so naturally we acted out of that, those states of mind. And what happens as we begin to turn towards them, it's as if we take off those lenses and look at them instead of through them. We can look at a state of anger or frustration without having anger or frustration in our minds. So that's a huge shift. It's a subtle, it sounds like a subtle thing because there's still the anger there, but we're not acting on it. And there is actually research that shows how this works in the brain. That the emotions are kind of in the core, the limbic system of the brain, and they're kind of responding and reacting. You're just acting out of threat or, you know, things I want, things I don't want, you know, just kind of being pulled and directed from that limbic system. And when you start meeting experience, just turning towards it, it engages other parts of the brain that allow that reactivity in the lower brain to dampen. So this, it sounds counterintuitive, but we can turn towards our experience and learn to meet it without reactivity. So the causes and conditions, skillful, unskillful, recognizing causes and conditions. A third kind of wisdom in this teaching is understanding the Four Noble Truths. The truth of suffering, understanding what suffering is in our lives, the truth of the cause of suffering, that it is craving that is the cause of suffering, the desire that things be other than they are is the cause of suffering. The truth of the ending of suffering, the possibility that it is possible to end suffering, that it's possible to realize that ending. And the truth of the path leading to the end of suffering, those qualities of mind, those practices that we engage in, which support us understanding these truths, that support us understanding what's skillful and unskillful, support us understanding cause and effect. And even this teaching on the Four Noble Truths, it embeds the teaching of cause and effect, because that second noble truth, the truth of the cause of suffering, is the cause for the first. The cause of suffering leads to suffering. The fourth noble truth, cause of happiness, is the Eightfold Path. Cause of the ending of suffering is following the path leading to the ending of suffering. And the fourth kind of wisdom that we meet, and this one, it can be talked about, obviously, as these others can be. This one is kind of, these are the insights that begin to arise as we actually engage in our practice. So this comes around to the other side of the practice in a way that, you know, first we need to start with some kind of understanding of what we're doing and how to engage. And then as we engage, we gain understanding directly through direct experience. And the last kind of wisdom I'm going to talk about just briefly here are the insights that we start to recognize. We start to recognize that everything, all experience is impermanent. We realize that directly. It's not an intellectual knowledge. We can hear this as an intellectual teaching and take it in as an intellectual teaching. And there's a huge difference between that and the understanding in the moment of seeing impermanence. The second is understanding that all experience, without exception, is not satisfying as a place for lasting happiness. That there's nothing out there in our experience that we can say, this is it, this will do it for me finally. If I keep this thing in my life, this will be it. Because everything's impermanent. Nothing can be that thing that if we have it forever. We can't have anything forever. And so everything, there is nothing that is ultimately satisfying in our experience. There's no experience or state of mind or anything in our lives that we can say, that's it, I'm going to hold that there, because we can't do that. So everything is unsatisfactory as being a source of lasting happiness, any experience. And the third is that there's nothing actually in our experience that qualifies as a me, as an I. That what we do think of as I, as me, is, well, it's actually a thought. It's kind of a mental construction. And it is, as everything else is, an impermanent fleeting phenomenon. It's just that we seem to have our minds are actually designed in a way, I think, out of some kind of evolutionary adaptation to create solidity out of rapidly changing phenomenon. I mean, I think that we couldn't really live if we didn't create this kind of solidity in our minds. Our perceptual process kind of coalesces things and says, oh, that's a chair. You know, if we didn't have the possibility to do that, every time we looked at the chair, I mean, there'd be a little bit of difference because our body moves or we move to the side and it looks completely different. So the data coming in is kind of completely continually changing. And there's a way in which our minds are designed to create this sense of, there's that thing. And it does this with ourselves as well. So it turns what's a process, and everything in our experience is a process, it turns a process into a thing. Our minds do that. And it does this with a sense of self. There's a sense of something that's, you know, pretty familiar that comes up regularly. Oh, that must be me. So that's a huge topic, and I won't go much more into that at this point. So these kinds of wisdom, we begin with a little bit of understanding of these four kinds of wisdom. And this, hopefully, if this kind of teaching has met some kind of an inspiration to engage, then the practice actually begins. That's where wisdom and faith come together. Confidence, willingness, different ways to phrase that term of faith. So we begin. We engage. That engagement is the aspect of energy of these five faculties. So these qualities of willingness, energy, mindfulness, concentration, these are the tools that we use. Actually, wisdom too is a tool. You know, we use the wisdom goes into our minds, and it's a tool for how we engage. It's how we direct our practice through understanding some of this wisdom, just even through hearing and reflection. Reflecting on how does this teaching impact me? How can I engage with it? Does it make sense to me? So wisdom at the beginning has these two kinds. It's hearing it, taking it in, and it's reflecting on it, thinking about it. Through that reflection, we begin. And these other qualities are, the next three are really the practice: energy, mindfulness, and concentration. That's the practice that we engage in. We engage, we apply ourselves to be mindful. And those two together, the application of energy to be mindful, begins to develop some continuity of that mindfulness, which leads to concentration. With concentration, with these three tools, energy, mindfulness, concentration, kind of begin to set up a container of our meditation. They create a container not only of our meditation, but of our lives, actually. It doesn't have to just be in sitting meditation. These three begin to orient us towards recognizing when we're being reactive, when we're suffering, and seeing the causes in our own minds, our own clinging, our own holding, our own reactivity, our own mental states, how they contribute to our own suffering. As we see that, the mind begins to naturally let go of those movements. And the mind begins to settle down. Our reactive, jumpy mind, the one that's going off this way and that way, trying to figure out how to get the next hit of happiness or get rid of the next bit of unhappiness. How can we manipulate, arrange, control, fix our lives to be what we'd like it to be? We begin to see that it's actually that movement itself to fix, to control, to change that is making us feel so unhappy, making us feel so unsettled. And if we can just relax into what is actually happening, there's a lot more ease in our minds. Even when things are really difficult. Actually, especially when things are really difficult. It's not that I'm saying we should not take action. That when things are difficult, we do need to act. Perhaps we need to act less than we think. But the actions that we take, one of these earlier teachings I taught of what's skillful, what's unskillful, if we take actions in times of difficulty, really helpful to recognize, am I acting out of greed or aversion or delusion? Is that what is the motivating factor? Or is it possible to connect with acting out of compassion, out of generosity, out of kindness? That will tend to head us towards more ease in our lives. So those basic tools settle us down. They begin to settle us down. We come to a place where there is a little bit less reactivity. We can start to turn our attention towards meeting experience as it is, meeting our experience, things as they are. So the concentrated mind begins to turn towards experience without these filters of greed, aversion, and delusion in our minds. And this is when we start to experience wisdom. This is when we start to have the recognition. Sometimes it's subtle, sometimes it's not so obvious, and so I'm going to name some of the ways that we that wisdom manifests. Somebody asked me in one retreat, what are the symptoms of wisdom? I like that way of putting it. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that. What are the symptoms of wisdom? How can you know that wisdom is growing in you? It can start kind of slowly. You know, it can start small. It might be, first of all, I'll just say that there are kind of a couple of different ways that wisdom can operate. You know, it can operate kind of quietly in the background, where it's almost imperceptible. And it can also be pretty clear that in a moment you see something starting to happen and you just recognize that the mind is letting go of it even as it begins. So it can be obvious at times, but sometimes it's kind of more quiet. So this kind of more obvious kind, the kind where it seems like it's just happening, we can start to feel a shift of perspective around something that's difficult. You know, we're angry at somebody, and then mindfulness begins. We notice the anger, and we recognize, oh, this is just anger. And there's a shift in our minds around how we're relating to that experience. And often in that kind of a shift, there's a little bit of a sense of space. It can be a little sense of a distance or a space between the reactivity and our observing it. It's like, oh yeah. And it's kind of like just looking at a child having a temper tantrum, or at least being aware that there's a child having a temper tantrum, you know, that it's just, oh, there's that thing happening again. So there can be that shift of perspective around something difficult. That's a manifestation of wisdom. That's wisdom operating in your mind. And it's not actually something, I mean, we can consciously bring in wisdom of the reflective kind to help us in this shift. So for instance, you know, in that meeting of some difficult experience, sometimes that shift happens automatically when mindfulness comes and it kind of feels like, oh, I'm mindful of that, and there's that feeling of a little bit of space. Sometimes we recognize that we're caught. We recognize we're struggling with some difficulty. And we can consciously at that point, because we're aware, even though we realize we're caught, we can kind of bring in some of that wisdom that we've learned. This is not me. This is not mine. This is not who I am. Or perhaps bring in some reflections around this difficulty. What purpose is this serving? Is this necessary? These kinds of reflections can help to reorient our mind to support that shift of perspective. But that shift of perspective is something that wisdom does. It's not something we can actively do. We can create the conditions. We can choose to engage in certain actions, behaviors that will create the conditions for that shift of perspective. That shift of perspective is the function of wisdom. Another way you might notice wisdom operating, or that you see, and essentially they'll all have that kind of shift of perspective. When you're observing your experience, starting to observe your how you're responding and meeting your experience, you may start to see how patterns unfold for you. Oh, this cause, when I don't get enough sleep at night, I get really grumpy. And then I tend to get angry quickly. That's a kind of a gross kind of understanding of causes and conditions. You may also start to see more directly in the moment as mindfulness is working. You might notice that, you know, your boss says something, and then in your mind there's a memory of your mother saying something very similar, and you got really mad at your mother, and so now the anger is coming up. It's possible to actually see those kinds of very fleeting causal links in our minds as mindfulness gets stronger. And this can happen in daily life. I have had this happen in daily life, where I see in a moment, setting my alarm clock, I see a memory and see a reaction to that memory. Loneliness results from setting an alarm clock because of some very fleeting things that happen in the mind. This is possible in our daily lives. Mindfulness can get continuous and strong enough to begin to see these kinds of causal links. So that scenario I just described, you know, setting the alarm clock, seeing a memory, seeing the reaction, the loneliness resulting, that particular pattern had been going on for me for several weeks. And that evening when I saw the connection, the mind saw it just go from one thing to another. The next night when I was setting the alarm clock, I remembered the whole chain of events, but the loneliness didn't arise. And it never arose in the same way. I didn't have that same every night loneliness going to bed. Something about the seeing in the mind of the links from one to another that lead to suffering, the mind begins to let go. This is wisdom. When the mind sees it's headed towards suffering, wisdom goes, I don't think so. Not going to go that way. So we can see this happening. So this is understanding the wisdom around cause and effect that can be seen in the moment. So in that situation, the seeing of the causes and conditions, you know, just watching how they led from one to another, the next evening there wasn't even the inclination for the mind to go to that loneliness. Then there can be seeing actually a step kind of more subtle, is seeing in the mind, and again, this can happen in daily lives. It sounds really subtle, but we can see this kind of thing in our daily lives with cultivating our mindful attention. We can actually see the impulse or the intention towards going towards a state of suffering. We can see ourselves reaching out for loneliness. Oh, do I really want to be lonely right now? I really want to revel in a good loneliness. Our minds do that. It's incredible. We want to suffer. We don't think we do, but some part of our mind has that drive. Oh, yeah, really want to get into a good Grinch right now. When we can see that impulse is happening before the Grinch or the suffering or the sinking into whatever state it is that the mind is kind of inclining towards. That state has not yet arisen. We're seeing the impulse, the intention towards that state. And again, this is cause and effect, but it's at a very subtle level of seeing the impulse towards a state. So we can begin to recognize what our mind is kind of moving towards before it goes there. This is another way that wisdom manifests. When the wisdom sees that intention towards something that is going to result in suffering, it will tend to let it go. Now, this means that we do have to get really familiar with the suffering. You know, we can't just, the mind has to really know what suffering feels like in order for this to happen. So we need to get really familiar with that pattern, the process of getting caught in a certain pattern over and over and over again. Often in my daily life practice groups, I talk about picking a pattern, picking a habit that you struggle with and suffer around, and get interested in observing it, get familiar with it. Start understanding how it comes to be. That process of getting familiar with that habit means that we get to spend quite a bit of time in the suffering of that habit. And we don't like to do that. But that's part of our process. It is a way that wisdom builds by meeting suffering, understanding that pattern as suffering, understanding that pattern as something that is not productive, wisdom begins to grow around that understanding, and more the mind begins to let go of that movement in that direction. Because we are built basically to want to be happy, to want to not suffer. We just fundamentally misunderstand how happiness comes to be in our lives. We think that it's about getting the things we want in the next moment and getting rid of the things that we don't want in the next moment. Trying to maximize our happiness around constructing an environment that we think we want. So that's a misunderstanding. So as we begin to recognize that the way that we have been operating actually doesn't make us happy, ultimately, we begin to be willing to explore other approaches. And the letting go of these patterns of reactivity, letting go of patterns around greed, aversion, and delusion, is the pathway. Ultimately, you know, the happiness around freedom from suffering is freedom from. It is freedom from things. It's not having something. It's letting go that creates that freedom and that happiness. Freedom is about letting go. It's not about gaining anything. So our wisdom can also operate kind of in the background, almost invisibly, you know, that we're not even aware of it. Kind of like wisdom that develops over time. And it's just, you know, it's just the natural state of things. And this happens just as we age, as we grow. You know, as you, when you were a child, there was probably something. I remember one time in so much suffering when my friend left. I was probably 5 years old, and my friend had to leave. You know, we had been having a good time playing together. And, oh, I just wailed and cried. I was so unhappy that she had to leave. I don't do that anymore. This is a kind of wisdom that just comes as we age, you know. It's like, you know, no, it's, you know, this is the way things are, you know. People have to leave, they go do their lives, you go do your life. And this kind of wisdom also begins to develop as we practice. The kind of wisdom where it's like, you know, things just aren't as appealing anymore as they used to be. As you engage in practice, for me, one of these is alcohol. I used to like to drink wine. I used to like to, you know, have a glass of wine with my meal at night. And, you know, just being mindful, noticing, engaging, I began to notice that when I had a glass of wine at night, it was really hard to meditate at night. You know, I wasn't particularly drunk, but the mind was just foggy and dull. And not only that, the next morning it was hard to meditate. It had a long response, that alcohol in the mind. And so the mind just kind of, you know, what was more important to me was clarity of mind. And when that just became so clear, it's like it was easy. It was easy to let go of that. So, you know, this is a kind of very gradual wisdom. It's not like a big bang or, you know, big insider, you know, bells and whistles. It's just very natural that things begin to fall away that are not conducive to waking up. So I want to leave a little bit of time. I've talked for way longer than I thought I would, and I can talk for a lot longer on this topic. So yeah, Bud, oh, there's a mic right there.
Could you say something about how metta practice enables us to see that there are elements in the mind, elements in our being that we can take refuge in that allow us to have faith that we can leave our habitual tendencies?
Metta practice and others.
I was thinking something that brings compassion.
Yes. The kindness. I mean, in that area of the three in the middle, the three faculties in the middle, mindfulness, energy, mindfulness, concentration, that's kind of the whole range of the practice. And essentially, in that terrain is that we both let go of qualities that are unwholesome and cultivate qualities that are wholesome. And metta is a huge one in that softening of the mind, of being able to meet experience with a friendly attitude. Some people, I'll just say this as a kind of a caveat, some people find that metta is very supportive in gaining that softening of the mind, essentially around, being able to meet experience. In the guided meditation, I talked about setting the relaxed container, the relaxed attention of the meditation. And that's the key. And metta can support that relaxed container. Can you bring a sense of friendliness to your breath, a sense of love even to your breath? Some people find that kind of bringing in of that quality feels not so easy. Actually it just feels more like just meeting the experience is easier than trying to bring in a sense of kindness or metta. So, people come in from whole different angles to that, finding their way to creating the container where the mind can be relaxed and soft and meet experience. I think all the approaches kind of come to that place. And metta can really support that for many people. It can really support that container. Just that willingness to meet experience itself actually is a form of metta.
I was thinking about bringing loving kindness to the disagreeable person or the difficult person as a metaphor for being able to turn toward and engage suffering. So as you see the result of bringing loving kindness to disagreeability, it becomes a confidence builder that,
yes,
if I can do what I just did.
Towards myself.
towards myself or towards this disagreeable situation.
That's true.
I can turn towards it in an open and what a metta type way.
Yes. So yes, that's beautiful.
With that experience under your belt, you become a little bit more confident that turning, engaging
with difficulty,
with suffering and difficulty will produce something that you hadn't anticipated and will be beneficial.
Yes, absolutely. Some people, I wouldn't want to say that has to happen first, because for some people, the metta practice is like the last thing that works for them. So, that these are all different tools and different ways to approach it. And for some people, being able to meet experience with metta does give that confidence. For others, for me in particular, I had to develop the confidence around meeting experience as it is before I could engage with metta. So, some people have different minds. Different minds work different ways. The key really is this relaxed attention. And whatever you can do to support your finding that container, and there are many wholesome qualities, gratitude, appreciation, kindness, compassion, all of those can support that container. Yeah, thank you for the question.
So greed is fueled by a passion. So along the same lines that you've been discussing, maybe it would be even redundant, but how about the passion for practice? Doing some little alchemy and, you know, turning that passion, that greed passion, into a passion for practice.
Mm-hmm. There's one teaching. It's not a very... And people don't like to talk about this one too much, but there is a teaching, and I find it very helpful, actually, to think about the wanting aspect. I mean, often people say, well, there's craving, and then there is what might be called chanda, which is a kind of wholesome desire. But I've seen chanda used as unwholesome desire, chanda being the Pali term for desire. I've seen chanda used as unwholesome desire. And I've actually seen the term tanha used towards the practice. That there's this one sutta where there's a nun who's in love with Ananda, and she feigns an illness so that Ananda will come and tend to her in her illness. And he knows what's going on, and so he gives this little talk when he gets there. And he said, well, there's four things in our practice, and let's see if I can remember them. There's nutriment, and that nutriment can be used either towards moving towards suffering, or it can be used towards moving towards freedom. Then there's... oh gosh, I can't remember the second one. The third one is craving. That craving can be used to lead us into suffering, or we can also turn that desire, that wanting, towards the practice. And in that case, it can be used skillfully. So essentially, in this teaching, he's talking about things that can be used as bridges towards freedom. That we turn these unwholesome things towards, or things that tend to usually lead us into suffering, we can turn them towards the practice. And so that passion for practice, often there is talked about a sambhaga. Sambhaga is a term that means passion for practice. That's a fuel kind of for practice. And it can have some desire, some craving in there. So we need to recognize that part of craving that's in there, but not to try to stop it, because it's moving us in the right direction. The fourth thing that Ananda mentions to her, but he says this one, he said, this one with respect to sexual intercourse, the Buddha declared the burning of the bridge. You know, that we cannot use sexual intercourse as a path to practice. This was in the suttas. I'm not going to comment about that. Now, he didn't say that lay practitioners should not have their, you know, their healthy interpersonal sexual lives. Ananda was talking to a monastic, and so that is part of the context of this teaching. But I think also it is pointing to potentially that kind of passion that's caught up with sexuality, that's a kind of passion that is helpful to let go of in terms of turning inward and exploring our internal life. So he said for the first three, and I wish I could remember the second, he said that there are ways that they could be turned towards transcending suffering. And so there are ways to channel our energies towards the practice. For me, you know, the key is, where's the suffering? You know, if you're motivated towards practice, and I've seen this in my own life, my own practice, you know, periods of time where I'm just so on fire, so motivated to practice, and just, you know, really, you know, engaging, really sitting long hours, and then at some point in the practice seeing there's clinging to how I'm practicing. But that did not really get revealed as clinging and as suffering for quite a long time. So my basic approach along these lines is to look at, to use the guidelines the Buddha offered around non-harming, first of all, you know, that, you know, to refrain from harming self or other in the precept guidelines. Because sometimes we can be so deluded that we think, you know, it's not a problem if we do something that causes harm. So, to, you know, if we are so deluded that we're not feeling the suffering of causing harm, we need to use those guidelines. But using suffering as the guide, we can kind of navigate our way through that territory of that bridge, you know, that that passion for practice will be a motivator, and at some point in the practice, you'll begin to see where the clinging is and what needs to be let go of. You know, what kind of pushing needs to be let go of. So we need to stop. So thank you for your attention, and I'll see you when I see you.